Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. Business. Big companies are starting to hire again, defying predictions of AI wipeout. After a year of holding back on new hires, companies from tech and transportation to defense now say they need more people to work alongside AI by Chip Cutter. America's biggest companies say they might need more people after all. For months, major employers treated hiring as an expensive last resort. Now a shift is emerging across industries. Companies ranging from railroad giant CSX to Google parent Alphabet have told investors in recent days that they plan to hire to meet growth goals or to seize on emerging technologies. The push to expand headcount, at least modestly, is a reversal from the prevailing corporate message during much of the AI era. Major employers largely held back on adding people due to economic uncertainties or a belief that artificial intelligence could shoulder more tasks on the job. But some executives say the costs and limitations of AI now demand that more people be added. Others want to hire people back following layoffs. We actually need to accelerate hiring a bit. We're a little behind right now, Booz Allen Hamilton's chief operating officer, Christine Martin Anderson, told investors Friday. We're addressing that now. The government contractor cut thousands of jobs last year as the Trump administration slashed federal contracts and asked firms to justify their costs. Total headcount stood at roughly 30,900 as of June 30th, down 7.5% from a year earlier. But the company now sees healthy demand for its services, including in national security for workers who need security clearances. For much of the past 18 months, big employers were convinced fewer workers meant faster growth. U.S. public companies shrank their white-collar workforces. Now layoffs are shrinking. The most recent week of U.S. jobless claims was the lowest on record since 1969, according to federal data. Part of the change in hiring also reflects a recalibration among employers about what AI can do, said Sarah Franklin, CEO of the human resources platform Lattice. Many companies stopped hiring entry-level employees, thinking AI agents could pick up the slack. They have since realized that humans are necessary to work alongside AI. Just because you have coding agents doesn't mean you're not hiring engineers, she said, adding that companies with AI sales agents also need salespeople. Across Lattice's thousands of clients, many are now back in hiring mode for a number of roles, particularly junior positions. There's a big thirst for that, Franklin said. What you have now is a realization that you need the AI-native skills. You need this entry-level workforce, which is innovative, not calcified in thought. They're also more affordable because they are newer to the workforce. The pickup in hiring goes beyond white-collar professionals. Toolmaker Snap-on said it plans to add employees to expand its business. CSX said its train and engine service headcount will increase modestly in the coming months to help it meet higher demand, even as it looks to technology to make up for attrition in other parts of the company. The transport company noted its headcount is still lower than it was a year ago. Few companies are saying they plan to go on major hiring sprees, and employers are also making clear that they are in the market for certain types of workers. Alphabet Chief Financial Officer Annette Ashkenazi said the technology company expects to continue hiring in key investment areas such as AI and cloud computing. The software company ServiceNow wants to hire more quota-bearing feet-on-the-street sales execs to capture growth in areas like cybersecurity. M. Keith Waddell, CEO of staffing firm Robert Half, said that AI's impact on the job market are proving to be more benign than some have feared. The firm works to place people in roles from tech to financial services, and some clients are recruiting again. Hiring demand continues to improve, and market conditions are increasingly more supportive of our business, he said. Some caution, though, that much remains unclear as AI's ultimate potential continues to evolve. Do we need more people? Do we need less people? Asked Paul Osterman, a professor emeritus at MIT and the author of Disposable Workers, a new book on transformation of employment. We have no idea. No one has any idea. Osterman said many companies treated employees as dispensable, cutting them when convenient or downgrading them into contractor or part-time roles. He expects that trend to continue in this moment of flux. AI introduces so much uncertainty with employers, not sure knowing what they need or don't need, he said, adding that the drumbeat of AI's power to displace humans and save shareholders money won't stop. Who's going to be the victim of all that noise? And on to our next story. Technology. CXMT's strong debut boosts China's bid to conquer memory chips. The memory chip company raised $8.55 billion in China's largest IPO in more than 15 years by Yang Ji and Sherry Quinn. Chongzi's Memory Technologies is on track to become China's most valuable listed company as its shares surged in its Shanghai trading debut, buoying Beijing's campaign to become a global force in semiconductors that power artificial intelligence. Shares of the memory chip company jumped to 48.23 yuan early Monday from their initial public offering price of 8.66 yuan, bringing CXMT's market capitalization to 3.225 trillion yuan, equivalent to $476.21 billion, topping the country's state-owned banks and major oil companies. CXMT is at the forefront of China's efforts to stop relying on foreign technology, a mission made more urgent by U.S. restrictions aimed at keeping Beijing from catching up on frontiers like AI. Its success is being seen as a test of whether Beijing can produce a domestic champion to secure its tech supply chain. So far, the signs look good. When asked about using Chinese memory chips like CXMT's, Apple chief technology Tim Cook told the Wall Street Journal in an interview that everything needs to be on the table. However, CXMT's chairman Xu Jinming avoided directly naming any specific customers during a recent roadshow when asked about Apple, saying the company will continue expanding globally. The market seems confident in CXMT's ability to rival top memory firms like Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix. The company raised $8.55 billion in China's largest initial public offering in more than 15 years. The timing coincides with the major sector surge, with official data released Monday showing that China's electronics industry profit jumped 96.9% in the first half, driven by skyrocketing AI computing demand. Operating without a single controlling shareholder or de facto controller, CXMT built its foundation on backing from state funds and tech giants like Alibaba and Xiaomi, and is expanding that ecosystem by issuing shares to top-tier subscribers such as state pension funds, equipment suppliers, and the founders of Alibaba and DeepSeek. The massive buy-in reflects CXMT's strategic importance. Handling everything from chip design and fabrication to packaging and testing, the Anhui-based company is Beijing's best contender in dynamic random access memory, or DRAM, the short-term memory chips powering mass-market consumer electronics and high-performance AI hardware. CXMT is already the world's fourth-largest DRAM producer, but the gulf between it and the top three, Samsung, Hynix and Micron Technology is large and their command of the market daunting. Research firms' data estimated that CXMT's foreign rivals control over 90% of the global market. The Chinese company's market share stands at about 8%. Investors will be closely watching to see how well CXMT deploys its IPO cash to narrow the gap. It has a tailwind in AI, which has spurred a shift toward producing specialized chips for processors made by the likes of NVIDIA, AMD, and Google, causing a severe shortage of mainstream memory. The resulting surge in memory prices helped CXMT achieve profitability for the first time last year, and its growth has since shifted into overdrive. For the first 6 months of 2026, the company expects to report revenue of $16.2 billion to $17.7 billion, far outstripping the $9.1 billion made during all of 2025. An expected net profit margin of 45% would place CXMT's financial efficiency neck and neck with its global peers. Although a capacity gap remains, existing production lines are near full capacity, making immediate expansion vital, Guilin Minsheng, securities analyst, said. The memory crunch also makes it more likely that global tech giants will want to use CXMT's chips despite other countries' heavy trade restrictions around Chinese exports. CXMT has already integrated its chips directly into the supply chains of device makers like Xiaomi and Lenovo, as well as other tech giants like ByteDance and Alibaba. While the successful debut proves China can mass produce advanced memory, major hurdles remain. In the long run, CXMT's valuation hinges on expanding global market share, maintaining access to chip making equipment under U.S. sanctions, and making headway in advanced AI memory, analysts said. Company leadership, however, sees those challenges as a core mandate. CXMT aims to bridge key gaps and ensure supply chain security with independent research and development, Xu said during the roadshow this month. And on to our next story. Exclusive: artificial intelligence. NVIDIA in talks with OpenAI to guarantee $250 billion financing for data center. Project would be one of the largest AI computing hubs and involve power controlled by the U.S. government, by Anissa Gardizi, Amrinth Ramkumar, and Corey Drybush. NVIDIA is in talks to provide a roughly $250 billion backstop for OpenAI as part of a massive data center project, one of the most ambitious financial transactions yet in America's artificial intelligence boom. The guarantees from NVIDIA would help the ChatGPT maker lease a 10-gigawatt project that SoftBank Energy subsidiary is developing in southern Ohio, people familiar with the matter said. In total, the project could cost more than $500 billion, including the chips that would go inside the data centers. It would be the largest data center project announced to date. The power for the project is controlled by the U.S. government and funded separately by Japan under a recent trade deal. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick is involved in deciding who will get the power, some of the people said. NVIDIA's backing would allow the data center developer, which is owned by Japanese billionaire Masayoshi Son's investment firm SoftBank, to raise debt at more favorable terms than it could if OpenAI had no financial backer, since OpenAI has no investment-grade credit rating as an unprofitable private company. The AI company has been in advanced talks to lease the site for several weeks, people familiar with the matter said. OpenAI is among the companies that has shown most interest in the site, while Anthropic, Microsoft, and Google have also spoken to Lutnick about it in recent weeks, one of the people said. AI companies are desperate to secure chips and power needed to run their models, making mega projects that have government or guaranteed power increasingly attractive. Under the arrangement, NVIDIA would guarantee a series of financing vehicles intended to make lenders feel more confident that the funding behind the project is secure, the people said. Terms haven't been finalized, and the deal could fall apart. The $250 billion guarantee would cover the data center lease and debt needed to fund its build-out, but not the NVIDIA chips that would go inside it. NVIDIA, which has invested $30 billion in OpenAI, is also discussing a deal to finance the chip purchase for OpenAI, which could total $350 billion. People familiar with those discussions said, such circular funding arrangements have caused concerns that the industry is vulnerable if investor sentiment shifts or growth slows for AI companies. The campus would require roughly 10 gigawatts of electricity or enough to power several million homes and take many years to complete. The first phase of the project is expected to be finished in 2028 with around 800 megawatts of power, according to people familiar with the deal. Lutnick and the Trump administration also have a lot riding on the Ohio project. As part of the commitment to invest in the U.S. in return for lower tariffs, Japan agreed to invest $33 billion in a natural gas power project on federal land in Ohio that would be operated by SB Energy, which is effectively controlled by Sun. SB Energy has received an investment from OpenAI, and SoftBank itself is one of the largest investors in OpenAI. In March, Lutnick, Sun, and Energy Secretary Chris Wright broke ground on the data center complex. By using federal land in Ohio, the government and its partners hope to avoid the permitting headaches and local opposition that are snarling data centers across the country. The project is on a decommissioned uranium enrichment site about 50 miles south of Columbus. It will still take time to finalize the financing and acquire all the equipment. The U.S. government will provide a fee to SB Energy for operating the power plant, one of the people said. Japan and the U.S. will split the power sales until Japan recoups its $33 billion, after which the American government will get 90% of the revenue. The arrangement shows how the administration is trying to accelerate activity in critical industries by directly partnering with the private sector. The proposed structure reflects a shift underway in how the largest AI buildouts are being financed. Investment-grade technology companies are increasingly using their balance sheets to help smaller companies borrow money for their infrastructure needs, a phenomenon known within the industry as a credit wrapper. Google, for instance, has backstopped some data centers for Anthropic, in part to increase sales of its in-house AI chips, known as Tensor Processing Units. The data center would be OpenAI's first as a tenant, bringing it closer to controlling the infrastructure it now primarily rents from cloud providers such as Microsoft, Amazon, and Oracle. The company recently raised its projected spending on computing power to around $750 billion through 2030, up from a projection of roughly $600 billion earlier this year. It isn't clear how the new deal would affect those projections. The company and Anthropic are racing toward IPOs with eye-watering valuations, increasing pressure on them to continue growing quickly. With a roughly $5 trillion market value, NVIDIA is also racing to lock in greater chip demand. In its most recent annual report, the company warned that data center funding arrangements could lower its near-term cash flows and increase its exposure to customer credit risk. And on to our next story. World. U.S. and China are jockeying for drone supremacy on Mount Everest. Washington is seeking an edge for American technology in the race to support climbers, but China had a head start. By Krishna Pokharel. One day in May, Sergio Gore, President Trump's special envoy for South Asia, appeared at the base camp of Mount Everest. Dressed in a black jacket emblazoned with Trump Force One, Gore sang the praises of the drone displayed next to him. The U.S. is pushing an American drone to challenge China in a new race to support mountaineers, setting up an unusual superpower contest in one of the most remote areas of the world. The finest technology in the world, American, said Gore, of an industrial drone made by Freefly Systems, a Woodinville, Washington-based designer and manufacturer of heavy-lift drones. The U.S. is lobbying for Freefly to enter the new business of using drones to deliver supplies to climbers and carry away the trash they leave behind, a task on which China's SCDJI technology has a head start. The contest has geopolitical undertones. Mount Everest straddles the border between Nepal and China. Beijing's investment and involvement in Nepal have grown significantly in recent years. Meanwhile, the U.S. has designated DJI as a Chinese military company. Since 2024, Nepali drone company Airlift Technology has been working with DJI to test and deploy its heavy lift drones to deliver supplies from base camp, situated at around 17,500 feet to the next camp at 19,900 feet, and collect trash left by climbers, helping to relieve the dangerous burden usually borne by Sherpa expedition porters. After earlier testing a model that can carry a roughly 65-pound payload at sea level, Airlift deployed the DJI Flycart 100 drone at Everest for this spring's climbing season. That drone can carry more than 200 pounds at sea level and about 100 pounds on the mountain, according to the company's specifications. Flying at higher altitudes reduces the payload the drones can carry. The Chinese drone maker said this year delivered thousands of pounds of supplies and hauled away more than 6,000 pounds of refuse generated by climbers. That includes used oxygen cylinders, discarded climbing gear, and human excrement. The drones make a grueling job a little bit easier by delivering a hot breakfast in minutes to Sherpa climbers who set out in the middle of the night with just headlamps to guide them. This year, a DJI survey drone also mapped the Kumba Icefall, a deadly stretch of the ascent marked by towering shards of ice and yawning crevasses, to help veteran Sherpa climbers known as Icefall Doctors plan safer routes. Washington has over the years flagged risks that Beijing could access data collected by DJI drones around the world and potentially manipulate or interfere with the aircraft. In December, the Federal Communications Commission banned the use of new foreign-made drones in the U.S., a move aimed largely at Chinese firms. It's unfortunate for our innovation-driven industry that countries of origin often overshadows the technological breakthroughs solving real-world problems, said a DJI spokesperson Friday in response to a query about the U.S.-China rivalry at Everest. The company has previously said U.S. suspicions about its drones are unfounded and are a form of protectionism. The U.S. Embassy in New Delhi, where Gore is based, declined to comment. In the run-up to Gore's visit to Everest, Airlift, the Nepali company that operates DJI drones there, was set up to help Freefly carry out a flight up the mountain, said Airlift co-founder Milan Pandey. The American Embassy in Nepal said at the time that U.S. commercial drone technology will enable deliveries at Mount Everest in a few minutes, in contrast to multiple-day treks. However, the night before Gore's scheduled arrival at base camp, Nepal's Home Affairs Ministry told local authorities in the Everest region that it wouldn't grant permission for the flight of the American drone, according to an April 30th letter seen by the Wall Street Journal. The ministry said it needed to consult with other stakeholder agencies regarding security sensitivities. Asked to comment, FreeFly described its device as the world's toughest drone, but didn't address specific questions about its potential use on Everest. In the same April letter, the ministry pulled the permit for the DJI drone that it had granted in March, the start of the spring climbing season. The fallout from that decision illustrated the importance the drones have already assumed for climbers. In the spring, the icefall doctors had finally managed to open the Khumbu icefall section after a massive overhanging glacial chunk called a serac blocked the path for much of the early climbing season. With only a month of the season remaining and a record 495 climbers from dozens of countries itching to get started, anxious expedition operators surrounded the government's field office at the base camp, asking it to resume drone supply flights to the higher camp to make up for lost time. "We will uproot your tent," some of them said, according to Kim Lal Gautam, a Nepal government officer in charge of monitoring mountaineering activities at the base camp. 5 days later, the Home Ministry gave the go-ahead for the DJI drone to again operate on Everest for 3 months, while reiterating rules that require drones to maintain a minimum distance from the country's international borders, in this case with China. It also said that the drone shouldn't capture imagery outside its permitted area of operation. Binoj Bastiat, a retired Nepali Army Major General and an independent strategic analyst based in Kathmandu, said the initial decision to restrict both the U.S. and Chinese drones could be interpreted as an effort to maintain strategic neutrality, while the reinstatement of the DJI drone showed the tension between strategic neutrality and practical necessity. The U.S. government's push for a foothold for American drone technology on Everest recalls the history of geopolitical jostling in the Himalayan region during the Cold War. In the 1960s, Nepal's mountainous region of Mustang, west of Everest, was the base for CIA-backed Tibetan rebels fighting against China for the independence of the Tibetan region. The U.S. remains one of the most prominent backers of the cultural and political rights of Tibetans, tens of thousands of whom are in exile in India and Nepal. Farther west, on the Nandi Devi Mountain in the Indian Himalayas, the U.S. and India collaborated in 1965 to install a nuclear-powered monitoring station to spy on Chinese nuclear tests and missile firings, an effort that failed after a heavy blizzard forced the climbers to abandon their equipment. Airlifts Pandey, 32, said he believes that Chinese and U.S. drones need not be rivals on Everest, but could complement each other. His team tested the FreeFly drone after it arrived in Nepal and found it could lift 33 pounds at sea level. Based on their data from operating drones on Everest, its payload would likely drop to about a third of that on the mountain, just a fraction of the Chinese drone's capability. The U.S. drone may have an edge on speed on the mountain, given it's far lighter than the Chinese machine. "A big drone takes time to set up, take off, and reach up there," said Pandey. "But FreeFly is smaller. It is instant and it goes straight there. That could make the American drone more useful for rapid emergency response and dropping light payloads. If a Sherpa worker or a climber falls into a crevasse in the icefall, FreeFly could launch instantly and drop a harness, rope, or medical kit directly into the crevasse within 2 or 3 minutes," said Pandey, expressing disappointment at not being able to test the U.S. drone on Everest. And on to our next story. World, Middle East, Trump pauses Iran strikes as officials weigh dwindling air defense stocks. The U.S. held off on a major military campaign that could have lasted 2 weeks, officials said. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on with our story. By Michael R. Gordon, Meredith McGraw, Shelby Holliday, and Laura Seligman. President Trump has put off a major escalation of his military campaign against Iran amid efforts to revive diplomacy to open the Strait of Hormuz and a debate over the impact of declining munitions stocks, according to U.S. officials familiar with the matter. The U.S. military had been poised Friday to launch an intensive series of strikes against Iran, which could have lasted up to 2 weeks, the officials said. But the operation was delayed so diplomacy could proceed, as officials discussed the effect a major attack could have on the U.S.'s shrinking stocks of Patriot and other air defense interceptors. The president could still order an attack, officials said, noting that the situation remains fluid. The White House has been informed of the declining inventories of air defense interceptors by General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, officials added. The issue is a concern for Kane, who believes that the low inventories wouldn't preclude a resumption of major combat operations against Iran, but would add to the risk, the officials added. A spokesman for Kane said he wouldn't discuss the chairman's confidential advice to the president. Several officials said Admiral Brad Cooper, who leads Central Command, believes the U.S. can cope with the limited stocks of Patriot and other air defense interceptors because stepped-up U.S. strikes, if they are approved by Trump, would blunt Iran's ability to launch large numbers of missiles. A spokesman for Central Command declined to comment on Cooper's planning. Trump denied that dwindling munitions are a problem, insisting in a statement to the Wall Street Journal that we have far more munitions than anyone in the world and far more than we need. At the same time, the White House said national security would be at risk if news organizations reported updated U.S. government figures on Patriot and Tejada missile expenditures showing the high numbers of interceptors that have been used since the war began. Analysts outside the government have repeatedly cautioned that the large number of anti-missile interceptors that have been used to intercept Iranian missile attacks could hamper the U.S.'s ability to deter adversaries around the globe, including China. The diminished munitions stockpiles have created a near-term risk, said an April report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies by Mark Kansian, a retired Marine Corps general, and Chris Park, a research associate at the think tank. A war against a capable peer competitor like China will consume munitions at greater rates than in this war. That report covered the several key munitions that have been used in the war with Iran. Kansian and Park, who have been updated their April assessment, said in an interview Sunday that they now estimate that at least 1,500 Patriot interceptors have been expended since the war with Iran began. That would leave a U.S. inventory of less than 1,000 Patriot interceptors, they added. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt and Sean Parnell, the Pentagon's chief spokesman, insisted the military has everything it needs for any mission Trump chooses. The continued threat posed by Iran's missiles was underscored last week when three Iranian ballistic missiles struck a base in Jordan, including one that hit a housing area for American service members at the base. Three U.S. soldiers were killed in the attack. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that most of the missiles that were directed at the base were shot down. Other U.S. officials have said that Iran's missile force is using different flight paths, maneuvers, and speeds, which is challenging U.S. defenses and increasing the use of anti-missile interceptors. Gulf states have also drained many of their anti-missile interceptors, which has become a concern for the Pentagon, according to U.S. officials. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has said previously that Iran's missile program is functionally destroyed. But U.S. and Israeli officials familiar with intelligence estimates said in April that Iran still has thousands of ballistic missiles in its arsenal that it could use by retrieving launchers from underground storage areas. The New York Times reported Saturday about Trump's plans to hold off on a major military operation and Kane's concerns over munitions stocks. Expectations that the U.S. was on the cusp of a major offensive were raised last week when Trump said he was considering a major attack. Cooper had prepared a number of options, including an intensive campaign that could last 10 to 14 days, officials said. The U.S. military began to move aircraft and weaponry to the region. But on Friday, Trump signaled that diplomacy had reemerged as an option and that U.S. officials were communicating with Iran. "There's a military exit where we just keep going, just the way we are, and we can even make it a heavier dose, and it's knocking out everything they have," Trump told reporters Friday. "Or there's a smarter strategy that you make a deal, and they want to make a deal. Trump administration officials said that Gulf nations, including Oman, whose diplomats visited Tehran on Friday, are trying to revive diplomacy. Qatar is also involved, one of the officials said. Gulf states aren't the only ones conferring with the White House. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to meet with Trump in Washington on Tuesday. The Israeli leader said in a statement on Sunday that he plans to discuss all pending issues, which he said will include the situation in Iran. The Israeli and the U.S. militaries have participated in the attacks on Iran, but Israel has refrained from striking the country since June at Trump's request. The Trump administration hasn't said whether Israel would participate in fresh strikes if the U.S. renewed a major air campaign against Iran, but some U.S. officials said that might be an option. And on to our next story. Yes, America's big cities are rapidly losing kids. The number of children is falling across the U.S., but the decline is especially pronounced in big metros. By Rachel Lewis Ensign and Paul Overberg. When Fernando and Patricia Escobedo moved to the Willows, an affluent neighbor in El Paso, Texas, 25 years ago, kids were everywhere. About half the homes on their cul-de-sac had children. Growing up, the couple's twin daughters used to ride their scooters outside with other neighborhood kids. At an annual block party, they jumped around in a bouncy house and climbed into the local fire truck. The twins are now in college, and the neighborhood feels a lot different. The Escobedos also have a 12-year-old at home, and Fernando said she is one of a few children under 18 on the block. The local elementary school has noticeably fewer kids, and Fernando said he's more likely to see a retired neighbor gardening than a child on a bicycle. "It's not the vibe it was 10 years ago when there were still kids here," he said. With the nation's fertility rate at record lows, the number of children under 18 is falling across the U.S. The decline is especially pronounced in big cities, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis. The number of children under 18 living in big U.S. cities is down 6% in the past decade, the journal found, compared with a 1% decline nationwide. The drop is especially stark among families with little kids. The number of children under age 5 in big cities fell 15%. Compared with a drop of 7% nationwide. Even cities that are gaining population are losing children. In all, the number of children declined in about two-thirds of the 38 U.S. cities with more than 500,000 residents. The journal analyzed census data from 2015 through 2024, the most recent data available. Families with children cite concerns about costs, safety, and quality of life in their move away from cities. Also contributing to the drop is a growing number of childless residents opting to stay that way, worried about the financial implications and lifestyle trade-offs of having a family. In San Jose, California, where median household income is nearly twice the U.S. level, the number of kids under age 5 has dropped 34% in the past decade, more than any other large city. Ernie and Samantha Solis both grew up in the San Jose area and lived in the city for the early years of their two sons' lives. Buying a home was out of reach on their respective salaries as a firefighter and teacher. Daycare costs about $25,000 a year for each child. They worried about state vaccine mandates. In June 2021, they moved to Star, Idaho, a small town a short drive from Boise. "I was just over it," said Ernie. He flies into the city every Monday for his job, stays in free dorms for firefighters during the week, and returns to Idaho every Friday. He's met other dads, electricians, HVAC technicians, and auto body shop owners doing the same commute. In California, the family rented an older 1,400-square-foot home. In Idaho, they own a 2,300-square-foot house with space to park their RV. They had a third child, a daughter, after moving. Among relatively affordable cities, the number of children has fallen 15% in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and 11% in Milwaukee. City economies are starting to feel the shift. Families are important contributors to a city's tax base, and middle-class families, in particular, drive demand for goods such as affordable groceries that benefit everyone. Fewer kids means less support for public schools, often one of the largest employers in many cities, and tough choices as classrooms empty out. Some municipalities are rolling out free childcare, but it isn't clear if it will be enough to convince people to have children or families to stay. National trends. After the 2008-09 financial crisis, people stayed in cities because that's where good jobs were. But as economic growth became more widespread later in the 2010s, families started leaving for opportunities elsewhere, said Connor O'Brien, a fellow at think tank the Institute for Progress. The decline in city kids started in 2017 and picked up with the pandemic. COVID opened the door for remote work, leading many to reevaluate their lifestyles. Some moved to the suburbs or even farther. Families had more exit options and they took them, O'Brien said. The falling birth rate is also a major factor. The number of births in the U.S. has fallen 9% in the past decade, largely due to fewer women having children in their teens and 20s. Nationwide, the birth rate is falling even more dramatically for Hispanic women, who made up a sizable share of the population in some cities. An analysis by O'Brien found that birth rates in large urban counties fell 18% between 2010 and 2024, the biggest drop of any county type. Of the 38 U.S. cities with over 500,000 residents, the journal found, 13 saw the number of kids grow. Those cities, many in the Sun Belt, are often relatively affordable for middle-class families. They saw the number of children increase 7% over the past decade, while their overall population grew 12%. 17 other large cities saw their populations grow, while the number of children living there dropped. In some cities that are losing kids, the falling birth rate is a bigger factor in the drop. In others, it's families moving away. In Albuquerque, about half of the 15% decline in children is from more families leaving than arriving, according to the journal's analysis. The rest is from the falling birth rate. Births in Bernalillo County, where the city dominates the population, have dropped 20% in the past decade. In more affluent Denver, the number of children has dropped 9%, a combination of a small loss due to more families with children moving out than in and a drop of 7% in the number of births. Across a decade, that translates to almost 7,000 fewer births than if totals had remained steady. Expensive cities. In New York, where the cost of living is high, the number of children is down 8% over the past decade. Since 2000, the city has lost a net 80,000 households with people aged 30 to 54 who are married or have at least one child under 18, a decline driven by middle-income families, said Melissa Pumphrey, chief economist at the city's Economic Development Corporation. Over that period, New York gained a net 670,000 households of single people or families without kids under 18. Parents have to earn $334,000 to be able to comfortably afford childcare for a two-year-old, according to an analysis from the city's comptroller. The median rent for an apartment with three or more bedrooms is $5,495 citywide, according to Street Easy. A couple of years ago, Razim Bazil was paying $750 a month to rent a room in a home in Queens. That was about a quarter of the monthly take-home pay he earned working as a truck driver for the U.S. Postal Service. He applied for apartments in a city-run affordable housing lottery, but never landed one. When Bazil got engaged in 2023, he and his long-distance fiancée immediately started making plans to leave. He had started considering a move years earlier when he was living in public housing with a daughter he had from a prior relationship who is now 12. Bazil looked into the Long Island suburbs, but they were too expensive. He and his now wife, Kira Bazil, eventually settled in Easton, Pennsylvania, which has about 30,000 people. Last year, their son was born earlier this year. Here I feel much later, said Bazil, who now works in real estate. New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani is rolling out free childcare to help families stay in the city. So far, the new program covers a small group of two-year-olds. Brooklyn resident Jenna Edwards always assumed she and her husband would have children, but they had trouble conceiving. They started visiting a fertility clinic in 2019, but learned the projected bill for the initial treatments would be $4,000 to $22,000, even with insurance. There was no guarantee it would work. She worried about other potential costs, too, the hospital bill, daycare, nursery school. The couple who live in a below-market rate, rent-stabilized apartment would probably have to move. Edwards, now 44 and a freelance content creator, decided against doing IVF. Finances definitely influenced just how hard we were willing to try, she said. It's easy to get almost angry or resentful that it influenced so much every step of the way. More affordable cities. Even in less expensive cities, the prospect of having a child can be financially daunting. In Philadelphia, where kids are down 6%, Nyjah Rivera, 39, grew up working class in a row house with her sibling, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. She now runs a grant-writing consulting firm and lives in a two-bedroom condo that she owns with her husband, who works as a mariner. Rivera does hot yoga daily and takes dance and acting classes. Her husband is taking a year-long guitar program. Having a child would likely mean sacrificing the time and money they spend on those activities. I love taking classes and learning new things, said Rivera. I didn't get the chance to do all that stuff as a kid. She also wants to be able to support her own mother and stepfather if they need help in the future. Homes in El Paso are less expensive than other cities, but they're still up 32% over the past 5 years, according to Redfin. El Paso's total population is flat over the past decade, but the number of kids has dropped 9%. That was driven by a 30% drop in children under five. With enrollment down, the El Paso Independent School District is closing elementary schools to save money. Fernando Escobedo, who is 55 and works in finance, says his elderly parents block in the city, where he spent his childhood summers roaming freely with other kids, is also quiet. The annual block party on his own cul-de-sac never came back after COVID. The people who are left are the parents, older parents, said Escobedo. Economists worry about an aging population because it means fewer working age taxpayers and more retirees reliant on Medicare and Social Security. Still, the cost for providing education and other services for children can add up. Some cities that have faced a drop in kids have been able to pare spending on public schools, but others have struggled to do so, leaving a bloated level of per-student spending, said Jeff Clemens, a professor at the University of California, San Diego. The big risk is that a decline in families is part of a broader population decline and erosion of a city's tax base. The places that are effectively replacing families with affluent childless adults are so far avoiding this fate. Tennille Jordan enjoyed attending local festivals and other events when she lived in Milwaukee after graduating from a local college. Jordan, who is 38 and works in corporate training, was aware of the city's relatively high crime rate, but felt she could keep herself safe. She soured on city living now that she and her husband have a 3-year-old. Their doorbell camera has captured people stealing packages from their stoop. A nearby playground has rusty and broken equipment. The family installed playground equipment in their backyard, but that means their son rarely plays with other kids. The couple is planning a move to the suburbs of Green Bay, Wisconsin, where they hope their son will be able to attend good schools and play with neighbors. It just seems like a very nice place where I would have no problem letting my kid ride a bike down the street, Jordan said. And on to our next story. Exclusive business. This lawyer upended big law once. He has a plan to do it again. David Fox, who helped build Kirkland and Ellis into a top law firm, now sees AI as the industry's future. By Lauren Thomas. David Fox upended the legal industry once before. He hopes to do it again. The longtime dealmaker is credited with devising the playbook that helped make Kirkland & Ellis the biggest law firm in the world. His new pursuit could one day put him in competition with Kirkland and its peers. Fox, 68, co-founded a software company, Irving Technology, that is powering a newly launched law firm called Irving, which employs only a handful of lawyers and primarily relies on artificial intelligence. "I hope I have one more revolution left in me," Fox said in an interview. Fox believes Irving and similar ventures could permanently change how legal services are delivered to clients and funded. Elite law firms are just beginning to game out how AI could remake their business models. The need for investment has already prompted many to explore alternative ownership structures, and industry leaders have been debating how the technology could shrink headcount or alter fee structures over time. Fox is in the camp that believes AI will free lawyers from repetitive tasks and let them focus on the thorniest issues. He says clients in turn will be charged less money. Irving software is at a basic level trained to be about as smart as a high-performing senior-level associate. Irving will be going up against a bevy of other legal AI upstarts and the major AI developers themselves, as well as established firms, each of which have been charting their own futures with AI. Kirkland & Ellis recently said it set aside $500 million to create its own AI platform rather than rely on tools also used by competitors, while Freshfield struck a deal with Anthropic to co-build specialized AI applications. Clearly, Gottlieb bought legal tech firm Springbok AI, bringing a team of AI engineers in-house. Several so-called AI-native law firms are already in operation. Many, like Irving, involve two distinct business entities, one housing the lawyers and one housing the technology, which allows for outside investors in the latter. One called Norm Law, which has hired senior lawyers away from firms including Ropes & Gray and Sidley Austin, is powered by an AI company backed by Bain Capital and Blackstone. Another legal tech company backed by General Catalyst is behind a new AI-powered firm called Udia Counsel. Then there are off-the-shelf products such as Harvey, Legora, and CoCounsel that are quickly becoming ubiquitous across the industry. A dealmaker, Fox was born in New York, but his family moved to Israel when he was 9 years old. He moved back to the U.S. in 1983 to launch his legal career at Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meagher, and Flom. Fox worked at Skadden for more than 2 decades, rising up the ranks to become the firm's most senior partner and among the highest paid lawyers, working on marquee deals, including the $6.6 billion leveraged buyout of Toys R Us in 2005. In 2009, he shocked the legal industry by departing Skadden for Kirkland & Ellis, which at the time had only nascent mergers and acquisitions practice. He brought with him Daniel Wolfe, a longer Skadden partner on the rise. Fox, with the help of then-chairman Jeff Hams, formulated a plan to make Kirkland a juggernaut in M&A. It revolved around resetting the culture at the firm's New York office and plucking up-and-coming lawyers from other firms. He also steered lawyers to focus on bigger deals. By 2020, when Fox stepped down from the firm's executive committee in keeping with the firm's age limits, Kirkland was working on more deals annually than any other firm. Fox said the new leadership team has since taken Kirkland to even greater heights. Last year, it helped Kirkland become the first law firm to crack $10 billion in annual revenue. Fox, who now splits his time mostly between Miami and the New York area, says leaving Kirkland was never meant to be a formal retirement. He is keeping busy with projects beyond Irving, including a small venture capital firm, Anti-Portfolio Ventures, that makes investments in legal tech companies such as Sandstone and Patlytics. Fox's other partners at the VC firm are Ryan Morgan and Mike Devlin. He also finds time for days-long biking excursions on his collection of motorcycles, and spends time with his wife, who works in furniture design, and their 22-year-old daughter. He is in the early stages of building a center for AI at the Hebrew Institute of Jerusalem School of Law, where he studied. The industry's big question. Irving Technology has raised a small sum of money so far from investors, including Naria Capital, the venture capital firm co-founded by J.D. Vance before he entered politics, the New York-based venture firm Addition, Hams, and Fox Anti-Portfolio Ventures. Its three other co-founders are engineers with backgrounds at technology and defense companies, including Palantir Technologies. That's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.